From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, an inland port in Utah. It's an idea developers and business people have been fantasizing about for years, a huge distribution hub for offloading and distributing freight from around the world, and not on a coast, here, which means trucks and trains and lifts and containers and machines. We're talking about the latest plan on the program. Could we handle it? We'll be right back.
KUER is listener-supported public radio. And our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Yesterday, after we had recorded this show about Utah's inland port, a group of community activists interrupted the meeting for the state's Port Authority Board. About 20 people or so brought with them a banner and a megaphone and chanted slogans until the board took a recess and eventually canceled the meeting. The incident reveals not everyone is on board with this idea of Utah's inland port. It's a huge distribution hub designated for 20,000 acres in northwest Salt Lake City. This is land situated in the migratory path of millions of birds. Now, proponents of the port have been thinking about the idea for years, for decades, and now they have a process in place. They have the land. They have the support of state leaders. But as you can tell by yesterday's meeting, they have critics who have questions about whether Utah, which already suffers from bad air and crowded freeways, is in fact the place for a bustling complex like this. So today, we're going to be talking about the inland port, what it is, and what it means for supporters and opponents. But we're going to begin with some basics. We began our conversation with our producer, Benjamin Bombard. What exactly is an inland port?
Well, an inland port is a land-based port as opposed to the number of sea-based and other water-based ports that the United States relies on to import and export international goods.
So, it's like a sea-based port, but it's just inland.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
Pretty basic.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot of these are connected. A lot of inland ports are connected to seaports. Some are even run and operated by the seaports that they're connected to. They serve as land-based hubs for the distribution of goods coming in and out of the United States.
One of the things you've mentioned is you say there's some reason to believe this could be the wave of the future. I mean, if you look at the new economy, people are buying a lot of stuff online, and they need to get that stuff to them.
Faster and faster.
Faster and faster. Yeah. So this is it accurate to say in some ways this might be the wave of the future?
I think that is where we're headed. It kind of makes sense when you consider interconnectedness of the globalized economy. It's getting more and more prolifically connected. And if you're moving more and more goods through the same number of nodes, of kind of transport nodes, yeah, that the ports kind of serve as, the more nodes that you can add to that distribution web, conceivably, the faster you can distribute goods. And the internet creates all kinds of expectations for increased speed. Mm-hmm. You know, Amazon has their next day delivery. And we want it now. When we order something, we want it now. But what's happening at a lot of the seaports is that goods are getting backlogged. They're getting bottlenecked. They're waiting on land before these containers, these big shipping containers, are broken down, and all the various goods that are inside them are offloaded and loaded onto truck and rail and sent
goes
to their
the customs
final destination.
Process. All of that.
Yeah, go through all the customs process. Exactly. It's a lot of effort, and the thinking is that if you can spread those efforts around, you can expedite that process.
So explain why it is Utah might be right for something like that. What is it about where we sit that might make Utah ideal or a good place for this?
Yeah, there have been a couple feasibility studies that have noted the fact that Utah sits at an interesting crossroads. We're the crossroads of the West, especially the Intermountain West here. It's interesting when you look at a map of Utah and you see the interstate highways and how they're all connected. And here in Salt Lake City, we have a major interstate interchange between I-80 and I-15 that connects San Francisco all the way to New York City. It connects Alberta to San Diego. And we also have, of course, the railroad that runs through here, the Union Pacific, and that provides direct access to the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, two of the busiest ports in the United States. And it could also be extended, proponents say, to the ports in Oakland, in the Bay Area, and Richmond. So once you look at that, it seems like a pretty great place to establish one of these nodes. There's a lot of different avenues for distribution. Add to that the fact that the future location of the inland port has been laid out by the legislature is almost right next door to our international airport, which is undergoing a multi-billion dollar upgrade. So when you look at that, you've got the potential to move goods via rail, road, and air. And proponents also point to Utah's historically low wages, and our economy is growing.
And Utah wants to be part of this new global trade economy.
It's an opportunity.
So there's a lot of to things
participate
that are converging.
In that directly.
Okay, so give us a sense of what something like this looks like with the scope of it. How much land are we talking about? And if I'm sitting in the east part of the valley, or any part really of the valley, can I see it?
Yeah, I think, you'll definitely be able to see it. It's 20,000 acres. And right now, if you look out from the east benches, it is mostly open land. There's a lot of, there are shorebirds out there. There it's scrub land. There are antelope out there. And it's pretty open. It's one of the last open places in the valley. It's roughly 20,000 acres of land that will be that's set aside and will likely be developed for the inland port. It will likely be composed of a number of warehouses, probably some amount of factory space, shipping yards, shipping docks, lots of trucks.
Does it look like a shipping yard at a port on the seaside? Would it look like that with those big cranes and things like that?
I wonder about that. I lived in Oakland for a time, and there are these giant cranes at the Port of Oakland that look like dinosaurs, mm-hmm. and they're actually kind of cool. But I also worked for a time at a shipping dock, a freight dock in Salt Lake's industrial corridor. And it is a bunch of trucks and trailers running around. It's not a place a lot of people go unless you have reason to for work.
How big a deal would this be for the state economically? I mean, you hear proponents say it's the biggest, I've seen it described as the biggest economic opportunity the state has seen. Does that get to it?
It remains to be seen, I think. The proponents say that it would be a great boon to the economy. They tout its potential to create thousands of jobs, and it could likely do that, looking at some other examples across the country of inland ports. Its precise economic impact hasn't been much elucidated. There's still a lot of study that needs to be done on what kind of financial impact it could have on the state.
So that's a big question.
It is a big question. There has been a feasibility study that was conducted and released in 2017 that looked at some of the costs associated with this. That study found that to be fully functional, the inland port would cost between about $200 and $300 million and would run, this is a crazy number, it would process upwards of $472 billion worth of goods and move about 300 million tons of goods by 2045 through Salt Lake City, through the inland port, we should say. It could create thousands of jobs. Having worked at a shipping dock myself, it's good, honest work. It pays decent. They're not the kind of jobs that a lot of people aspire to.
And who's to say you're going to have forklifts in 2045?
Yes,
right?
Yeah. I think robotics, the increased presence of automation in our factories and in our transportation, I think with self-driving cars, it remains to be seen how much of these jobs, how much of the functions of the inland port will actually be performed by humans.
You mentioned some of the other models in other places. There's an inland port in Kansas. There's one in South Carolina. Are we able to tell by what's going on there what might happen in Utah? Or is it too early to say, do you think?
I think it may be. I think it's probably early to say, just because this is in its early stages. But will there be high tech factories there? Will there be aerospace factories? All other kinds of manufacturing possibilities out there. Derek Miller, who's been very integral in this process throughout its entirety, has pointed to...
We should point out, he's CEO of the Chamber of Commerce.
He's president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce. He was previously president and CEO of World Trade Center Utah. And he's also the chair of the board of the Utah Inland Port right now.
Yeah.
And he's pointed to... A inland port in Greer, South Carolina, which is connected to the port of Charleston, a very important port on the eastern seaboard. It's a very successful inland port. It's undergoing a multi-million-dollar expansion right now. It's attracted a number of businesses.
BMW is one that has apparently been drawn there or is potentially going to be
BMW
drawn there?
BMW was there before the inland port was established. It's actually the largest volume factory for BMW in the world. So what happens when a shipping container leaves the port of Charleston, or arrives at the port of Charleston, some of them, they're put on a rail car and sent directly to this Greer inland port. It's about 200 miles or so from that seaport. And there, the goods in those containers are unloaded and unpacked and distributed elsewhere. And then you're left with empty containers. What do you want to put something in those containers to send them back and to export your goods. So BMW... It's perfect for the factory. It's created a number of jobs. It created about 8,000 jobs that one inland port did.
Let's get to one of the major critiques of something like this, an inland port in Utah, and that's the environmental implications. What could this mean for? And we'll get into the details with another guest here in a moment. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. People are worried about the air, mm-hmm. right? The quality of air. We are already worried about the quality of air. This could,
definitely
be more problematic.
There are a lot of concerns. As you mentioned, we already have some pretty poor air quality here. The concern is that introducing more industrial infrastructure and more industrial equipment, they use a lot of energy. And they put out a lot of waste. There's concerns about the impact on the Great Salt Lake ecosystem, which is long migratory routes for millions of migratory birds. There's also the concern, and I think this bears a little more investigation, of the potential for the introduction of invasive species here in the Intermountain West through these ports. That's a concern that's been raised by the Utah Audubon Council.
We should mention fossil fuels, too. Let's say something about that, because that's a big concern that in some way fossil fuel interests are having a big influence on the process, that the inland port would be a way of transporting coal. What can you say about that? We'll get into some details here in a moment, but give us a broad sense of what that's about. The concerns.
The concerns about the transportation of fossil fuels through the port, I think, have to do primarily with the connection between fossil fuels and climate change. People are worried that Utah is contributing to the exacerbation of those conditions by continuing to export coal. It's conceivable that opening these shipping opportunities from Utah directly to seaports being passed through customs here would circumvent the concerns of other ports, such as the Port of Oakland, that Utah has tried and failed to ship coal through. These rail cars, as another of our guests, Dita Seed, will likely tell you, would also aid the transportation of waxy crude from northeastern Utah, the Uinta Basin. So I think it's mostly that it could potentially perpetuate the use of fossil fuels in an era when we know that they're problematic.
Give us a quick sense, Ben, of how it is we got to this point. I think this is interesting. I hadn't realized you've mentioned that state leaders have been talking about some version of something like this for quite a long time.
Yeah, almost 45 years, since 1974 was when the legislature first took this up. They passed a bill that allowed for the creation of port authorities across the state. Nothing really happened with that, though. No port authorities were made.
It was just an idea at the time.
It seemed like it was just an idea, but it wasn't long, really, until the idea was taken up a little more fully. In 1987, a task force further investigated this idea. It took them about 3 years to complete their research, and they found that, yeah, this is a pretty good idea. So in 1990, the legislature again takes up a port authority bill, and this one is much more robust. It lays out a full timeline, a whole process for developing the Port Authority and what its purview would be and the process. But there was some dispute over how it would benefit the state economy, whether it would actually be a boon to the economy. And
this was before the internet would really, and internet retail really took
hold.
Yeah,
that's
probably
a very good point.
Right?
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. That's a very good point. And ultimately, it was underfunded and it starved. It took a little bit. It took about 25 years, really, for this idea to resurface. A connection between the Salt Lake County and the Brookings Institute, and an effort by the Brookings Institute to kind of connect U.S. cities with the globalized economy and international trade kind of jump-started it a bit. And then in 2015...
Let me underline
yes,
this.
Please.
2015, this seems like a... This is, seems like there's this delegation of state leaders that go to China.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to really get the ball rolling for this iteration that we're talking about now. Yeah, talk about that.
So in 2015, shortly before this trade mission to China, it should be noted that a major shipping company, global shipping company, Orient Overseas Container Line, establishes a headquarters in South Jordan and christens one of their cargo ships the Utah. Hmm. And so Governor Herbert, Derek Miller of the World Trade Center Utah, Val Hale, the director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development, and others go to Hong Kong to attend this christening and meet with representatives from, among others, Orient Overseas Container Line, OOCL as it's often called, another major player in global shipping and logistics, Li and Fung Companies. And Derek Miller has said that this is where the idea for the inland port really came from. Previously, it had gotten rolling and just run out of momentum, but the momentum has been faster and more furious, I think, in this iteration of the inland port ever since that trade mission. It led to the establishment of a committee, the conducting of research at the Kem C. Gardner Institute of the possibilities of this, and then that was leveraged pretty quickly in 2018 into the legislation that passed through the legislature, establishing the inland port.
Right. So there's a lot we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? A lot we don't really understand. Is there any backing away from this right now? Or how is there any backing out of the process? Are they too far gone? Is it a done deal is, I guess, the question you hear. Any sense of that now? I'm guessing you're hearing both ways.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It seems like it has a lot of momentum. The financial problems that it faced in the past seem to have been allayed by a financial incentive that was built into the SB 234, which established the port, which provides a pretty good financial basis for the future of the port. It has the land necessary to achieve this goal, but does it happen? There's a lot of unknowns here. It could be a big economic boom. We're a growing state. We run businesses very well here. So it's entirely possible.
Finally, ultimately, one of the things you've mentioned is one of the things that's driving the concerns. I mean, beyond the legitimate issues, you say, are just people really uneasy about change. And this could be a big change.
Yeah, our state is changing immeasurably right now. It's really hard to grasp. And change is scary. A lot of the explanation for the benefits of this port half, their proponents are tying it to the fact that the state is growing and we need to create jobs. And this could create thousands of jobs. We may need to create a million jobs or more to account for the state doubling in size by 2045. Those changes are scary. The development of 20,000 acres in one fell swoop next to the prison, which is a major development, next to the airport, which is a major development. It's moving our state forward at a pace that it's disruptive, and disruption is scary. The future is scary.
That's Benjamin Bombard. He's a producer here at Radio West. Benjamin, thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
I'm Andrew Becker, the news director here at KUER. Our newsroom is growing, with new reporters set to join us in the coming months. In the meantime, we want to know, what issues should we be covering where you live? What stories should we be telling in your community? Help us improve our coverage of Utah by answering a few short questions. Go to KUER.org and click Community Feedback Form under the About tab.
Joining us now on the program is Chris Conaby. He's the interim director of the Utah Inland Port. I guess I wanted to begin with the sense of scope and what kind of an opportunity you think this is or could be. As we were talking about with Benjamin earlier, there are those who say it's the biggest economic opportunity the state has ever seen. Do you put it in those terms? Are you thinking about it in those terms right now?
Yeah, I think it's a tremendous opportunity, but, you know, all opportunities are born out of demand and process, right? And, you know, when I look at what you discussed on your program as a port being a land-based hub for goods coming in and out of the nation, you know, you'd intimate there's a lot we know and a lot that we don't. And I think what we do know from fact is our population, according to a lot of studies, including the Kemp-Gardner study, is going to double here in the next 20 or 30 years. And that two-thirds of that growth, roughly 67% of it, comes internally from our own people having children. And in addition to that, we've added about 400,000 people since 2010. We see the buildings go up in downtown Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. We see the freeways getting more congested. You know, I remember in the 80s, you'd drive your car in downtown Salt Lake, and there was a car in front of you. You'd get upset. It seemed like traffic, right? We have a new demographic of that now. But if we're going to double our population, then we start looking at what happens in terms of shipping goods, and you had addressed that earlier. I mean, the value of goods ships between 2015 and 2043 is effectively going to double, and that's dollar amount of goods. Because we're the crossroads of the West, you know, when we get that traffic and when we get those goods, they don't just come to our state, they come through it. And so when people talk about the port, you know, sometimes I think I wish I could go back in time and call it, you know, the Utah logistics facility or something, right? Because when you think port, you think ships and cranes and busy stuff. I look at this as an opportunity for us to take an area of ground that Salt Lake platted for M1 designation, which is warehouse and light manufacturing, and to get manufacturers in that area that marry up with our society, what we want to do in our educational facilities to make sure that we get the highest paying jobs and the best things put there. And when we start diving into that in our preliminary research, we notice that some of these warehouse and distribution jobs, you know, they bring a lot of trucks and traffic, but in addition, they become dark facilities in the next 20 years and they don't employ anybody. And so we need them. We have to have them. Whether they do or don't go dark, you know, we're going to need warehouses. We're going to have plenty of warehouse just because of our physical location in the United States. And we want that work. But in addition to that, where can we lever that opportunity and get into light-scale manufacturing that has higher pay scale? Where can we get to those?
Isn't it true that it will be – I mean, people do envision cranes and busyness and trucks coming and going, but if to get this right, it will that be that, won't it?
I think to get it right, you're going to have a blend of everything. And I think, you know, when you talk about trucks and shipping, can it be a zero emission port? Can we use electric trucks? And one of the interesting things, you know, this is like an onion. The more you peel back, the more research you do. We're lucky that the legislature has committed over $1 million a year in funding so that we can do this research. But one of the things we learned is that a port is the only entity that has the ability to control trucks. So a city, a municipality, a state can't say you can't drive a 2006 Dodge into our port because it pollutes more than a 2008 and has a different vehicle standard. So when you look at emissions through HEAL Utah and some other organizations, we see emission quality going down in the next 10 years, but that's just because of the regulations that have been put on the trucks. We as a port can actually say we only want 2007 or newer trucks coming in our facility, right? So the first step was the listening step. We went out and did a bunch of public survey work, got about 3,000 surveys in the door, a lot of them from the East Bench area and not directly affected by the port by nearby neighbors. We've put into three different languages to try and make a little better work done there. But we're hearing what you'd intuitively know, right? People don't want traffic. They don't want air pollution. They want to protect their environment. They want a high-paying job, but they don't want it to be a dirty job, right? They want to be part of the modern economy.
What makes you think it's going to be high-paying jobs? You mentioned some, but there's also the concern that the more sophisticated we get, the higher the technology, the more we're going to have robotics doing these
jobs. Yeah, it's a great point. I think the pressure on us as an inland port is that we also don't control the land, right? The land is owned by private property owners. We're trying to take these property owners, set a common vision, use some of their tax increment dollars to do mass infrastructure, clean mass infrastructure to make sure that we save the environment around us. And so we've stood up about six working groups, and that's kind of a who's who in the state. It's an open working group. Anyone's welcome to join us around not just the environmental sustainability, but also around port technology so we can look at the latest and greatest port technologies around road, rail, air traffic, air quality. And so these will all go into three different scenarios similar to what was done in some other state initiatives. We'll look at those scenarios, and then that'll come into a master vision that'll get put back to the public and tweaked a little bit, and then we'll put a business plan on the end of that. And at the end of that process, is that a seven-digit process? Sure, but the state decided that it was worth that to pursue it. And I don't know if the local entities would have the wherewithal or, they may have the wherewithal, but I don't know that they would have the ability to commit to doing $1 million worth of survey work and funding and research. And to be honest, this is, the Northwest Quadrant is a really special intersection of downtown Salt Lake and a very sensitive environmental land. And so we only have one chance. We got to get it right. We got to bring everybody to the table. But the last statistic I would leave you with, which I think is an important one, is, currently we get about $147 million worth of freight into the state, and 99% of that comes by truck. My fear as the interim executive director isn't that distribution and warehouse and trucking will come. It's coming. It's how do we manage it, and how do we master plan it, and how do we use the tax increment to lessen the effects of it? That's our goal as a port.
How do you lessen the effects of the fact that this will be placed in a, as you yourself said,
sure,
a very sensitive migratory bird area anyway.
Yeah.
It's a deeply – this is one of the concerns for people is the environmental implications of that. What do you do about that?
Well, you have to bring the right people around the table, right? So when I talk about our environmental board, we have people from the Audubon Society. They're actually presenting at our meeting later this afternoon to talk about that. We have an entire working group on the environment. When Salt Lake City went through the zoning process to create the M1 designation, they had a buffer zone around the port that separates it from the neighboring properties that are zoned agricultural. The fun part about revisiting that is
So you guys would consider something like a buffer zone?
Oh, yeah. I think we'll have to task our board. I think that's the goal tonight in hearing from the Audubon Society. But I think we would definitely mirror the buffer zone that was put in for Salt Lake. I think the real
But how do private entities – what do? You impose those sorts of things?
No. I think that the buffer zone was already accepted in the zoning from Salt Lake City. So it would be those landowners in the port, basically recognizing that buffer zone and supporting it and making sure that what we do outside the buffer zone doesn't infiltrate the buffer zone. There's some specific stuff that you discuss with invasive species and other things around that. I think one of the few opportunities that we have is although we take the buffer zone from the port, what's between the lake and the buffer zone is still some more private property, right? And that's zoned agricultural and designated agricultural. But, is there some opportunities for conservation easements and working with some of those property owners as well? So we could see that buffer zone actually grow out towards the lake because, in my opinion, I'm a little bit of a one-trick pony. But when I look at it just rudimentarily, a buffer zone that doesn't have a buffer to where you're trying to get to doesn't act as much as it could. So, and no one's ever had an opportunity, like I said before, to commit funds and personnel to kind of explore that. So, as much as these initiatives are scary because you're dealing with real problems and you're trying to solve real problems, there's opportunities in there where we can do better work than you'd do if it didn't exist. And that's when people ask me to be involved, that's why I got involved.
I'm trying to get a sense of how you're responding to the idea of air quality. It seems like what you've been saying is, look, this is coming through our state anyway. But what do you say about that? I mean, how many more trucks are you envisioning being on the roads? Like, what is the impact that, and how are you thinking about air quality?
So to give you an example, there's an Amazon distribution center that was just put out there. You could have about 19 plus more of those. You could have hundreds of millions of square feet just in the base zoning that's already there. And the base zoning, you know, Salt Lake City runs its departments very well, and they do a great job of constituent services. You know, they ran a true planning process and understood that there's a need for this for their city and for the greater region. So, you know, for us, the idea isn't, you know, how do we just copy Salt Lake's plan, but how do we improve on it? And they're still the base zoning. They still oversee zoning and water distribution and fire and sewer. So I think when you talk about the volume of trucks that can come into there and can come out of there, that really becomes not just land planning, but what I spoke to before, which entities are there. So for instance, if you look at an IM Flash facility out in Lehigh and Draper, very few stuff comes out of truck from there. It's all actually air freight. And so if you look at the cost of goods on a pound coming out of IM Flash for their microchip that go in cell phones, a pound of those is worth a lot of money, not a lot of tax revenue. If you look at steel, that may not be the same case. And so when I talk about how important it is to target the right industries to go in there, that's what I'm referring to, because it affects everything across the board. And so the first step was to do our listening. We've done that. The second step is to break off in these working groups, invite everybody to the table. We've had about 5 of our 8 working groups convened so far. We'll be doing that over the coming months to get that more and more refined. That'll go into models, and we'll have 3 models that'll come out for the port. We'll put that back to the public in terms of survey. We'll choose what the public wants in an optimized model, and then we'll maybe pull from one part or another if there were comments on it to make sure that we get that optimized. And that goes back to the public.
How do you know what the public wants?
We do it through survey. Same thing we've done with Envision Utah before and other consultants. And then that actually goes into a business plan. And then that's when I can sit in front of you and answer the question of what goes where and how it goes and how it costs and how we pay for it. But to do that, so oftentimes, and we're lucky in our state, but in other states you read about it. And you read about even, you know, Elwood, Illinois, and some other locations where they had this great idea and they just did it. They didn't test it. They didn't bring it back to the public. They didn't get public buy-in. They didn't have a common vision. And so I think this is the right way to do it. I know that this process came probably 6 months later than it could have. So that fear of not knowing, I think, got a little bit exacerbated. But yeah, I think we're moving in the right direction. I think our best days are ahead of us.
You mentioned that the city having good zoning laws in place for out there. But mm-hmm. of course, the mayor is not crazy about the way this process is playing out. She's talked about, in fact, filed a lawsuit saying that this process has usurped some of the functions of the city, who controls the land, the tax revenue question, whether, you know, who can impose restrictions and regulations.
Sure.
How are you responding to that?
You know, I think it still goes through a planning process through Salt Lake. So part of that isn't accurate. But I do think the tax revenue question, that's paramount as to what's going to get answered, right?
Who should make the money? Who should get the money?
Well, the money should go back into the site. I think that's always the process. The question is, you know, who's determining where it goes in the site and how it goes, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's the mayor's argument. And, you know, in her eyes, there's statutory law that the state couldn't have done that. And in the state's eyes, there's statutory law that they could have. And we're fortunate that we have 3 branches of government to sort that out for us. But, you know, the one thing that I do know that's positive is regardless of wherever that lawsuit falls, the work that's been done by the Port Commission in prepping the ground to make sure that the impacts of growth and logistics that come to our state are well planned out, and the money that's been sent on that, that'll last through no matter who ends up with the tax revenue.
Is it a done deal?
Is the port a done deal?
Yeah.
I mean, it was zoned by Salt Lake City. So once the Planning Commission said you can build warehouses out there, I mean, to me, that's the biggest stress, right? There are private landowners out there.
But we're not talking about just warehouses. We're talking about an inland port. Is that a done deal?
Is an inland port a done deal? So I think you go back to the question of defining a port, right? So if you're asking me, is a logistics center that moves packages, goods, by rail, air, and freight a done deal, I would say yes. In my opinion, that is a done deal. I think there's enough of a buy-in from the state. I think there's enough synergies with other areas of the state that there's state benefit.
But does that represent your vision? Is that a
personal vision?
Yeah.
Oh,
or the vision of those who want an inland port, that a done deal?
Yeah, from what I see, and this is just as the executive director, I serve to a board which ultimately serves to you know, all the citizens of Utah. But from one man's perspective, you know, we have, for instance, a landfill out there that has a $200 million remediation from all the garbage we threw out there, right? How's that going to get fixed? Well, I think there's some synergies with an intermodal port that could go in a location there or otherwhere that creates enough tax remedy to fix that. And that, you know, right now I know that stuff's leaching onto other properties, and that's a big mess. So it's not just about, you know, extending buffer zones and saving wildlife. It's not just about reducing truck traffic or improving air quality. And it's not just about remediating an old dump site. It's about looking at all the opportunities that are in front of us, getting them into a business plan, figuring out how we're going to solve the problems. And, you know, fortunately or unfortunately for us, our problem is growth, and it's coming. And whether there's an inland port or not, we're going to have to deal with that from a logistics standpoint. And, you know, I feel fortunate the legislature gave us some money to look at that.
Chris Conaby, he's the interim director of the Utah Inland Port. Thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Doug.
We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Want to take full control of how you give to KUER? If you're already a sustainer, you can sign up for MyKUER. You'll be able to update your contact and payment information, make changes to your monthly gift, and even leave us a message. Think of it like getting into the driver's seat. It's up to you where we go. Sign up for MyKUER at KUER.org.
Today in the program, we've been talking about an idea to create an inland port in Utah. Joining us now in the program is Dita Seed. She's a former member of the Salt Lake City Council, an organizer for the Center for Biological Diversity, an environmental advocacy group. She's also a member of the community group Stop the Polluting Port. Why wouldn't this be a potential boon for the state? The largest economic project the state has ever seen. I'm not sure if it's just that, but it could be big, could be, you know, Utah could be this critical hub and a massive industrial operation, jobs, opportunities. What's wrong with it?
First of all, we don't have any assurance that it's going to be this great economic boon. Other ports around the country have very mixed results. There's a port that was previously mentioned in Elwood, Illinois, that actually provides terrible jobs that are temporary warehouse jobs. There are no benefits, and it's basically destroyed the community. As we listen to the Port Authority folks talking about the kinds of jobs they'd like, they're not, which are high-paying manufacturing jobs, they're not able to articulate with any specificity where those are coming from. It's all highly speculative. So that's one set of concerns. But the other thing really that's driving the public outrage about this are the environmental consequences. This will, if it's a distribution hub, it's going to involve trucks. Trucks run on diesel. The technology does not exist right now to provide clean trucks on any kind of scale that would help our air quality. And we simply cannot afford in Utah to have further impaired air quality. We're already suffering seriously because of our poor air.
When Chris Conaby says, though, that, look, we can control for this. We can decide which kind of trucks we want to come into our inland port. How do you respond to that?
Well, there are a couple concerns with that. One is that the port board has given no indication that they're actually going to try and make this a zero emissions port. There's a port board member, Garth Tudor Ogden, who's a Sevier County commissioner, who said unilaterally in a City Weekly article recently that it's not going to be a zero emissions port. You know, this is a political game. And to understand what's driving this, you really need to follow the money. And people who are interested in making money are not necessarily interested in creating some kind of clean port. Right now, they're talking about it because they're trying to tamp down on public outrage.
One of the things you've talked about is that this has been motivated largely by developers. I guess I would say, so what? What's wrong with that?
It's entirely motivated by developers. Developers who are among legislative leadership, and they're interested in making a quick buck. And they're interested in making that quick buck off of tax revenue that we're going to hand out to them. So that's deeply alarming for a lot of us. I mean, if you look, for example, one of the scenarios is that the Burlington Northern Santa Fe would build an intermodal rail yard. And a similar facility that they built in Kansas City cost $250 million, and it was heavily subsidized by the community. And of course, it's contributed to all sorts of problems in that community, including impairing air quality. And Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad also had a profit last year of about $13 billion. Why should we be subsidizing private industries to build things that are going to harm our air quality? I mean, that just at the base, that's a very basic question. And those of us who are concerned about the sport submit that we should not be subsidizing those businesses.
I want to get you to talk about one of your concerns, and that is that in some ways this is a more of a way of helping the fossil fuel industry, and particularly, or maybe not particularly, but in some cases, coal, subsidizing the coal industry, making way for transporting coal. Talk about that part of your concern, if you would.
So one of the things that we've observed as we've been researching and watching this process is that there's an enormous amount of speculation around it. And everyone who's ever had a bad idea is kind of showing up, including fossil fuel industry folks. So there's a faction of fossil fuel industry interests that would like to use this port to create transloading facilities throughout the state to expedite the export of fossil fuels, waxy crude and coal. It does not make sense to bring the coal to Salt Lake City because coal is largely mined in central Utah, and there's a rail line, a Union Pacific line, that goes straight out from, I think, Nephi. But what's happening now with legislation that was just passed is that there's now a financial mechanism to help those private coal interests build transloading facilities with the same tax differential formula that's potentially going to be used to create a BNSF intermodal rail yard. So that's how they're looking at it. I mean, they're looking for subsidies, and they see the inland port now in its expanded form with this sort of, it's called the hub and spoke model, yeah, that they'll be transloading facilities throughout the state, and many of those will be fossil fuel transloading facilities.
What impact does it have on migratory birds in the area?
So for the port complex that's proposed adjacent to Great Salt Lake, it could have a devastating impact. Over 10 million migratory birds a year use Great Salt Lake. In a time of climate change, there are fewer places for those birds to go. So this is a more and more important place for those birds. Over 300 species are represented. And you build something like this, and we were actually at one of these working group meetings that Chris Conaby mentioned, and water quality experts from the state were talking about the problems with stormwater runoff and how that could pollute the water that the birds use. There are issues around mosquito abatement. Birds eat bugs, but if you're going to have tens of thousands of people out there, then you're going to be spraying for mosquitoes and other bugs, killing off the food the birds eat. Buildings are very distracting for birds. I mean, it's from the birds' perspective, it's an ecological nightmare.
Chris Conaby is talking about, though, the fact that, look, this has been zoned for warehouses and industry. There are ways of creating buffer zones. There are ways of mitigating these kinds of concerns and taking into account this sensitive area and the birds. What do you make of that?
That's wishful thinking. And I want to suggest to all the people listening to this also that the Port Authority is trying to create a narrative of inevitability. They want us to believe that this is a done deal, that it's going to happen, and if we're nice, they will give us a few little, you know, LEED certified buildings, you know, they'll greenwash it. But to really mitigate the impact on the birds would be incredibly expensive. And really the best way to do it would just say, no, we're not going to build here. We're going to protect this area. There are two distinct areas at issue here. The north side of I-80 is essentially a greenfield development. South of I-80 is developing in an industrial warehouse pattern. And we think that the two areas should be looked at differently and not lumped all together.
So one, okay, you concede this could be where industrial development could take place, but what you're saying is that other thing, that other space, just leave it alone.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And have very minimal development there. Certainly do not put a second rail yard, a BNSF rail yard out there. It's wildlife habitat, and no one has fully explored the consequences of this kind of development on wildlife, including the birds. Also, there was mention of an environmental impact statement. We have no assurance that that's actually happening or happening to the standard that we would approve of.
What do you think about this question of invasive species?
It's a huge issue that has barely been touched on. But, you know, other communities that have goods coming out at the rate that's being projected for this port have huge problems with invasive species. There are also issues about contraband. I mean, if this is a customs clearance unit, it creates a whole set of problems we have not had time to fully explore because we're dealing with, you know, the first order of business, which is what happens to our air quality, what happens to the millions of birds, you know, what happens to our quality of life in this community.
What do you mean by that?
What happens to our quality of life?
Yeah, I mean,
do we really need this? And what's interesting is in the Envision Utah survey, they're finding people hate this. I've gone to all of these working group meetings and heard this presentation over and over again. And yesterday, the staff from Envision Utah said it's rough out there. People don't like this. I mean, they're apologetic about it because they work for the port board. But the truth is that people in this valley understand the consequences of this and they don't like it. And there's no reason for us in a full economy where we're, you know, we have jobs everywhere. We do not need these bad warehouse jobs. This will not make or break Utah. In fact, I would argue that the detrimental aspects of this, diminishing our quality of life, furthering the air quality problems we have, hurts us economically. Who's going to want to live here?
I wanted to have you say something about this question of transparency and accountability, because this is one of the things that you've mentioned, is that basically this process has been giving power to, as you've put it, unelected, unaccountable people.
Yes. The way this all happened was very forced and very rushed, and it was driven by the development interests in the legislature getting excited about this idea. And in response, Salt Lake City knew that, or Salt Lake City officials were trying to run ahead of it, and I think they made some mistakes in terms of the rezoning. I think the rezoning to M1 was because of the pressure they felt from the state. They were trying to prevent the state from taking over. So the state takes over, and all of the tax revenue into the future, property tax revenue from this area, is now in the hands of 11 people who are appointed. Some of them are elected officials, but they're not elected. There's only one that's an elected official from Salt Lake City. And these 11 people, including a Sevier County commissioner, are going to be making decisions about what happens to 30% of the land mass in Salt Lake City and what our quality of life is going to be like going into the future. And it's appalling, frankly. It's a very similar scenario to the former UTA board. And, you know, we can see a lot of similarities in the lack of accountability. You know, the UTA board ran amok with development interests. And there's a similar thing that could be playing out here. And they're really getting ready to hand out money as soon as they can, which is deeply disturbing.
What do you make of the prospects of the mayor's lawsuit, this question that this inland port idea, they've usurped, you know, decision-making ideas, tax, land use policy, all of those kinds of things? Because it does get to the question of whether or not this is, in fact, a done deal.
Right. Well, I think I've talked to a lot of lawyers about this. I think there's a reasonable chance that the city will prevail with this litigation. And then what that does, there's a little question mark about, okay, what happens then? I think authority reverts back to the city is a likely scenario. And then the city can you know, drive the train and make decisions about what happens and what doesn't happen in a much more measured and thoughtful way.
What would the difference be? Would the city driving the train rather than others?
I mean, we haven't talked yet about the climate implications of this, but they're huge. And Salt Lake City has a plan to be dependent entirely on renewable energy, I think, by 2035. And, you know, so the city could start implementing in the planning process for what gets built there, the environmental policies and sustainability measures that we as a city have been working on for years. Right now, that's not reflected at all. We're just at, in what's currently happening, we're just at the mercy of these 11 unaccounted, unaccountable to us people who have no commitment to those things as far as we can tell.
Let me jump on your train metaphor more. Just one more finally. Do you see this? I mean, when you look at the new economy that's shaping up, when you look at the growth, it does seem like a runaway train. And I'm wondering if you think there's any way really of stopping it at this point.
Well, I don't think the question we need to answer is, do we stop this new distribution economy? It's a question of where do you put it? And we submit that you do not put it on a green field next to major migratory bird habitat in an area that is already struggling with horrible air quality. You can put that stuff somewhere else. And then there's the larger question about whether we can continue consuming things at the rate that we are, which is, bigger and maybe for another day. But let's be smart about where we put things. And this is not the place for an inland port, and it absolutely can be stopped.
Dita Seed, she's with the Center for Biological Diversity, also an organizer with the group Stop the Polluting Port. Joined us here in the studio. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.